is the Financial Sense News Hour with the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. Now, here's the Financial Sense News team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Welcome to The Big Picture for this week, and today we intend covering a topic that is intertwined with the economy and the stock markets and cannot be divorced from that. When oil initially fell from $100 a barrel to somewhere in the $20 to $60 range, it was thought to be good for the economy. I mean, the drop in oil and the subsequent drop in oil prices was thought to be good for the economy because it put dollars into the pocketbooks of consumers. Nobody at the pump was complaining, and so people thought this would act as some form of a stimulus, not to mention the cost of delivering goods, which is paid for by oil as well. But there is a downside to oil as its price kept falling and hitting a low in February of $26 a barrel. There have been consequences, and the consequences have been hundreds of billions cut from CapEx budgets from oil companies and close to 300,000 job losses in the sector. And obviously that's a negative, both politically and also a stimulation toward the economy. So even though the low gas prices have been a boon to the auto industry and consumers, especially if you happen to be traveling during that time, there are negative consequences which impact the economy as investment in the sector is being curtailed. It's really a strange dichotomy. Too high oil prices are bad for the economy. Too low oil prices are also bad for the economy. So just get rid of the oil.
<That's> It wouldn't work very well, would it?
No, probably not right now anyway, not till we get some alternatives out there. But as a result of all of this week, the IEA issued their midterm market report, which we're going to examine today and really look at the prospects for oil prices. Have they bottomed? Are we on the road to recovery? And what are the possibilities of some kind of a future oil shock? Will this come back to haunt us again? So, Jim, this is an important issue because, as you said, it tangles in with everything else, currencies and markets. What is the outlook for the oil bottom? Are we going to hit a new record or bounce or more pain? What do you think?
You know what? The IEA starts out in its report, and it starts out with this. There's, you know, obviously what they do is they try to forecast, and there's two comprehensive studies that come out each year. One is the BP Statistical Review, and then the other one is the Oil Outlook that's published by the International Energy Agency. And they start out their report this year with mentioning that, you know, a lot of these forecasts that have been made over the years haven't panned out. I mean, nobody thought when oil fell from $100 a barrel down to $70 a barrel or $60 that it would go down to $26 as it did in the beginning of February. So they said there's this enormous complexity of assessing the oil markets because many of the certainties that have guided past outlooks are now sort of unclear. I mean, what the markets are trying to figure out, John, is when do they come into balance? When does supply and demand come into a balance at a level that, you know, what we don't want to see is a huge spike in oil prices because that creates inflation that would cause the Fed to come back in and get more aggressive. And also that would be a big shock to the economy. So nobody wants to see that. But on the other hand, nobody wants to see it get to the point where it got in early February, where it got down to $20, $26 a barrel, where not even the Saudis are making money. And we'll talk about why $30 oil is a key figure for the Saudis, because that's the number they need to meet their budgetary needs, which they're not doing. So right now, there's this uncertainty regarding economic growth, especially in terms of what we're seeing in the emerging markets. Now, on the other side is supply, which is very unpredictable right now as a result of lifting sanctions, for example, on Iran, because up until the deal that Obama made with the Iranians, it was everything was focused on U.S. production. Everybody was watching the rig count instead of watching the global rig count because we were the main marginal producer. We're the ones that sort of began this large increase in supply, not only by consuming less, but also by producing more. When the U.S. went from 5 million barrels of production to 9.6 million barrels at the peak of production last year, I mean, that is a significant increase in supply. So we were all focused on what was going on here, and what's going on here is market-driven. It's not like a state-controlled oil company. American oil companies react to price just like anything else economically. So just as American oil production has been in decline, you now have, as a result of the Iranian deal, new oil production coming online from not only Iran, but also from Iraq. And so here's another monkey into the equation that nobody was expecting, this Iranian deal that Obama put together, which freed up and took off the restraints on Iranian oil production. And now you have a new supplier coming in, and they're saying, hey, look, we lost a lot of market share when we had sanctions. And they basically told the Saudis and other members of OPEC, we're not interested in cutting our production. It's already been cut as a result of sanction. We want to get back to where we used to be, because like any regime that relies heavily for the majority of its revenues from oil, that's the situation you have in Iran. It's no different than what's going on in Saudi Arabia. So, John, we had a new kind of geopolitical twist that was thrown into the equation that nobody was thinking about a year ago.
Okay, well, if we look at what the experts are saying, where do they believe the market is now? And then if based on that, what do they believe the projections are for the oil markets coming into balance?
I mean, since the peak of U.S. oil shale and the increase in oil production last year, there has been a build of excess oil, roughly about 2 million barrels a day. So we're building up these inventories, and we're also entering into that season right now, February and March and maybe parts of April, when there's sort of a downtime at refiners, and then it'll start gearing up in March or the end of March as refiners start preparing for the summer driving season. So even though U.S. production is expected to decline somewhere in the neighborhood of about 600,000 barrels this year, it declined about 400,000 barrels last year. So with the 600,000 this year, the 400,000 that we had last year, John, you're talking about a million barrels decline in production, but you're also talking about Iran and Iraq increasing almost a similar amount. So the IEA projects that the market really won't come into balance until sometime in 2017. Now, what has surprised the IEA, what has surprised OPEC and oil experts has been the tremendous technical innovation that has enabled many U.S. companies to drive down the cost of producing oil. And I can remember they were using figures like $60 a barrel, $65, $70 a barrel was the number to make a profit in shale. Now that figure has been 40. I've seen some companies say, hey, at 30, we can even make money here. So the reduction of U.S. oil production has taken longer than projected, as many companies can produce oil more efficiently at lower prices, not to mention the fact a lot of these smaller companies that went out and tapped the debt markets and had to finance a lot of their drilling and leases with debt, they have to keep producing because they have to meet those debt payments. And so that's another reason why you haven't seen a faster slowdown in production. So now that that is happening with the U.S., what nobody was seeing a year ago is this deal with Iran. And you want to take a look at Iran could eventually become the third largest producer within OPEC. Right now, second largest producer is Iraq. So here are two countries that are increasing their production and have been the main source of supply coming within OPEC.
Okay, if something's going to bring the markets into balance, the oil markets, what is that going to be?
I mean, there's three things that are going to bring the oil markets into balance. And number one is global consumption. Believe it or not, despite the slowdown in the emerging world, the U.S. is still consuming, or not just the U.S., which happened last year, but also the world is consuming more oil. Even China, we'll talk about later, is still a major source of increase in oil demand. So number one is global consumption. Number two is a depletion. We used to talk a lot about this when it was looking like peak oil in the last decade, because we're losing about 3 million barrels a day due to depletion, especially, let's say, the older oil fields in the Middle East and here in this country and elsewhere, like the North Sea or even Alaska. So depletion would be the second reason. And number three, the unsustainability of low oil prices. You keep oil prices down to 20 and 30, and even the big guys are going to start, not only have they been slashing projects, cutting back personnel, but basically they're going to have to start shutting down. It just becomes uneconomical, not only for the big Western different oil companies, but also for, let's say, OPEC countries themselves. I mean, outside of Saudi Arabia, very few OPEC countries can sustain low prices. That's why you see countries like Nigeria, Indonesia, Venezuela talking about, hey, you guys need to cut. But the Saudis are saying, hey, when you say OPEC needs to cut, you're really talking about us, Saudi Arabia. And even Saudi Arabia has to provide all these social programs. And unlike the United States, which has a diverse economy, OPEC countries, the main source of revenue for government social programs is oil. So that's why even Saudi Arabia cannot do this for a sustained period of time. We'll talk later why, you know, they're talking to the Russians about freezing production. So the main difference here, even OPEC has a point in which the game of chicken comes to an end because they can't sustain this. So unsustainability of low oil prices would be the third.
Okay. What I want to do is break these out. Let's examine each one of these assumptions and then explain why they are significant.
Well, let's start with growth. What have we been talking about over the last year? What are the markets worried about? And this is tied into oil as well as the financing of oil. It's economic growth. You know, everybody knows China's economy is slowing down. Everybody knows the emerging markets are slowing down. Russia's in a recession. Japan is in a recession. Europe is barely growing at 1%. U.S. economic growth has been slow, so everybody's worried about global growth. And that's slowed down considerably. And obviously, if global growth has slowed down, that means less demand for oil. That isn't necessarily true because lower oil prices, I mean, John, I don't know what it's like where you're at. In your neck of the woods, you probably see a lot more SUVs and trucks because of the weather that you guys have. But, you know, SUV sales, truck sales are going through the roof, number one profit area for the auto companies. I mean, you think of that compared to 7 or 8 years ago when everybody was talking about getting an electric car or a Prius or something that was economical. So despite all of the talk about slowdown, Chinese oil consumption last year increased by 5.4%. So if you look at global demand, it's coming primarily from non-OECD countries, mainly the emerging world. So oil demand has not been as robust, let's say, as what we saw in the last decade, but it's projected to grow by 1.2% a year, John, and that is over 1 million barrels a day. So one of the reasons we haven't seen things as robust, not just economic growth, but mainly two reasons. Vehicle efficiencies. Cars are getting better gas mileage. It's being mandated here in the U.S. China's economy is moving more away from an industrial base, more towards a consumer base. So, you know, even though we're not growing at 1.5 to, let's say, 1.7 million barrels like we were in the last decade. In fact, there were years in the last decade we were growing at over 2 million barrels a day. So the IEA projects that between 2015 and 2021, which is the time frame for their midterm review, that oil consumption growth will grow by 7.2 million barrels a day. Most of that, where is it going to come from? It's going to come from Iran, Iraq, and mainly the U.S. Demand is expected to decline here in the U.S. and in Europe as we become less of an industrial society, more of a service-oriented society, and as these vehicle fuel efficiencies are built in and alternative fuels are brought into a mix. I don't, around here, John, you can see buses or government cars that are run on natural gas. So they're not only alternatives that are coming into the mix, but nonetheless, growth is expected to grow by over 1 million barrels a day.
Yeah, and around here, big pickups, rah, 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 you know, macho stuff. So
now, is that mainly, I mean, does everybody live on a ranch, or is that basically, I've been told, you know, you live back east and snow and everything, you want that four-wheel drive vehicle or a truck to get around in harsh weather?
It's probably a combination of all of that. In other words, there's a huge amount of farming and ranching that goes on here. There's a certain machismo built into it. Plus, they haul their recreational vehicles in the summer. And also in the wintertime, you just need to be able to get around in the snow, especially if you have, say, you live up a hill on a dirt road, which there are a lot of people outside of town. If it's steep, then you're going to have four-wheel and or chains to get up to your house. So it all factors in. But, you know, you can see this pitch overcoming that if everybody's buying this stuff, when the prices go back up again, they're going to be stuck with big stuff. and it may be a gas guzzler. So, and we have our share of just average cars here in town, you know, running between here and Spokane. So it's pretty much the same. You know, I was thinking about the second factor that you were discussing there. That's depletion. It was a big worry last decade before fracking kicked in and started to offset that, and shale, as the older oil fields were going into decline. Now that seems to have counterbalanced so far.
I mean, right now, depletion, according to the IEA, is estimated to be somewhere around 3 million barrels a day. And also, John, when it comes to shale, shale wells are short-lived. They usually peak out in production in 2 to 3 years. These aren't the big, long-running oil fields that we had in Texas for a while, the Middle East, Alaska, the North Sea, which were giant oil fields that lasted for decades. So not only do you need to find new oil fields to replace the fields in decline, but you also need to drill new wells to replace shale wells, which are peaking usually 1 to 2 years, 2 to 3 years, their production peaks. So, and that's why you can see the fall off in production start to grow dramatically, because if you're producing oil from shale, you get a big pop the first couple of years. You get the payback on investment, which is why oil companies like it. But then what happens? You have to go out and drill another well. So if companies are cutting back on CapEx, sooner or later, this is going to start to balance out. So if you take, for example, 1 million barrels of new growth and add the loss of 3 million barrels a day due to depletion, eventually the laws of supply and demand begin to come into balance. What is really, I think, in this market is what has really changed here is the U.S. has become the swing producer in the oil markets. In the past, everybody looked to OPEC. If oil prices got tight, there was tremendous demand, they would always look to OPEC, mainly Saudi Arabia, to ramp up increased production. Well, that has changed completely. The dynamics have shifted in favor of the U.S. The major source of new oil supply in the last 7 or 8 years has been the U.S., which has increased its oil production by almost 5 million barrels. And so for the first time since the 70s, and this is remarkable when you think about it, the oil markets and prices are finally being determined by market forces rather than the control of a cartel.
When you talk about the foreign producers, okay, OPEC essentially doesn't exist in my mind anymore. It is Saudi Arabia. They are not being cooperative. You've got Venezuela, you've got Nigeria, you've got Angola, you've got countries that, if you think Saudi Arabia is in trouble in terms of the money they're short on their budget, yeah, think about what it's doing in a place like Venezuela. Saudi Arabia can't even produce profit per barrel at $30, considering what they've done to their budget.
Pure gross profit, and yet they say they're willing, yes, to go to a 20 a handle.
Yeah, because they've got hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars of foreign reserves, right? But think about what that kind of thing is doing to an Angola, a Nigeria, a Venezuela. There is pressure. This is all about market share. Now, when you talk about shale, when you talk about the U.S. is the marginal producer now. It's no longer OPEC. It's not going to be OPEC that says we're boosting 100 million, or I'm sorry, a million barrels a day or cutting a million. It's the U.S. Two-thirds of rigs have been idled. We've only lost 700,000 barrels. So why am I saying this is a bottom? Because that's going to snap back rather quickly. It's going to snap back rather quickly. You've got these builds in Cushing, but you're seeing a shrinking of gasoline inventories. Refineries are in turnaround, and they're going to go further into turnaround. They're starting to retool for summer blend gasoline. They're going to suck that out, and then you're going to see a spike in prices led by Brent, and that's when it's going to happen. It is a medium-term bottom, but it is a bottom.
That was Bob Yacino on CNBC. So there you hear that OPEC is no longer a controlling force. And there have been a number of investors, including Jeffrey Gundlach, who think that the oil markets have actually bottomed. Do you think we're close to a bottom, Jim?
I do. I think we're at a bottom, or at least close to it. Could we see spikes down on some kind of, I don't know, inventory report or some kind of growth scare about overseas? But, you know, here's the thing you got to think about. Anytime you hear they go, oh, geez, Chinese economic growth has slowed down. Well, it did slow down last year, and it was still up. Chinese oil consumption was still up 5.4% last year. But the third factor I mentioned, and that gentleman there sort of alluded to it, is the unsustainability is the other factor. I mean, Saudi Arabia may be able to produce oil at $4 or $5 a barrel and make a profit. But here's the thing. Saudi Arabia relies on that oil to pay all their social programs, government bureaucrats, everything to run the government. And they need close to $30 a barrel. So, and John, that's Saudi Arabia. Most OPEC government budgets are hemorrhaging right now, including non-OPEC member Russia. Now, while the cost is a factor here in the U.S., budget deficits are a limiting factor in OPEC. And that is why you saw recently Saudi Arabia kind of cozy up to Russia. And Russia is hurting as well. Their economy is in a recession. And they're trying to say, okay, nobody's going to cut their production. Nobody wants to do that because somebody will just try to steal market share. And that was the original idea why they didn't want to cut in November of 2014 that started this whole big decline that we've seen. But they're now starting to talk, okay, we know that demand is growing around the world globally because lower oil prices are a stimulus and, you know, more people in China buy cars or motor scooters, whatever it is. You now just have a new oil consumer. So if they dip below $30 again, look for further overtures coming from the Saudis. They are plowing through their currency reserves. Their currency reserves are down over $100 billion. They're talking about bringing Saudi Aramco public to raise money. So, you know, sooner or later, John, even the Saudis are going to blink.
Okay, so do you think we have a bottom here?
I mean, we're starting to see things that lead us to believe so. I mean, last year, global E&P spending declined for the second straight year in a row. It fell by 24%. This year, it's expected to decline by another 17%. So outside the increases coming from Iran of, let's say, 600,000 barrels, non-OPEC supply is expected to be flat or hold steady. However, the U.S., John, will continue to dominate the oil markets as it remains the number one source of new supply. And in the IEA report, they're talking about when, let's say, prices start to rise again and we ramp up our production by the million barrels that we're taking it down, in addition to taking that production back up by a million barrels, U.S. production is expected to expand by an additional 1.3 million barrels. So we could be producing more than what Saudi Arabia is producing now. So the only other sources of increased supply, if you think about meeting economic growth, is going to be the U.S., Iran, and Iraq. Are really, there's a couple others, but they're insignificant. We're the big three, the U.S., Iran, and Iraq. So the continued increase in oil demand and depletion are expected to bring the oil markets into balance, and the IEA is putting that best guess at 2017. There are people in the oil market that think it's going to happen much sooner. Prices seem to, you know, if we take a look at the charts, they seem to have settled in the sort of the high 20s, low 30s in that price range.
Remember before, Jim, I was talking about, you know, the monster trucks and things people are buying. Well, they're not quite monster trucks, just big pickups. And they're, you know, they're not exactly economical on gas, not to mention from an investment standpoint. But sooner or later, all of this is going to balance out. We've been at extremes and it'll probably go back up to where it was before and balance out at a much higher price per barrel. What happens then? This is going to be a shock to somebody, I'm going to guess.
Well, it usually is. I mean, if you look at, in fact, IHS Herald Week was or the last couple of weeks, and the oil executives are talking about, gosh, this is really, you know, some of the hardest times that we've seen in decades here. And John, anytime we've seen these spikes down, whether it was in the 80s when we got down to $10 oil or in 1998 when we got down to $10 oil, by 2000 we were at $35 oil. And that's usually what happens. The pendulum swings or spikes in the opposite direction. What happens? Psychology changes with traders in the market, and especially when you have so much of this based on the market in the futures market, which is leveraged, and all of a sudden everybody's piling into a trade instead of looking at the inventory reports where the inventory is increasing. Then you'll start seeing, oh my goodness, the inventory levels just reported, they fell by X amount, or you're starting to see economic growth pick up. And we're starting already, although it may be a nascent recovery, we're starting to see some of the global PMI start to pick up. And so at some point, John, we're going to be moving in the opposite direction, as we always do, and you'll start seeing some sharp spikes. The price will start heading higher. We get to 60, 70. Maybe we'll see some spikes to 75, 80, and be prepared for a shock, because one thing that's happening is most of this is being driven by free market. So the U.S. is responding to the price of oil. They're shutting down. Oil companies have laid off 300,000 employees. They've slashed capital expenditures. And unfortunately, drilling and ramping up is a time-consuming process. This isn't something like a factory floor and you flip on the switch and all of a sudden you're producing more widgets. And so at some point, we're going to be in a tight supply again, until things are ramped up. And when that happens, John, it usually takes place just like a shock. And I expect, I don't know when it's going to be. Is it 2017, 2018? It could be a geopolitical event. It could be weather related. It could be economic related, any of those variables. And you're going to see a shock come in on the other end. And that's just the way this market works. It's been that way for 4 or 5 decades, at least going back to the 70s, whether it was geopolitical or it was direct, in terms of supply shocks or even demand shocks, as we saw in the last decade. Much of what we saw in the price of oil was really a demand shock when you had the emerging markets. China's economy growing at 12-14% a year, India's economy growing, the emerging world, Russia's economy, all those economies coming into the world and placing extra demand on energy. And, you know, in the end, I think that's what's going to happen. I just don't know when or what the triggering event will be, but it'll be something. It'll be either a geopolitical event, it could be stronger economic growth, or it could just be something that happens that nobody is anticipating. It could be anything. It could be depreciating currencies and everybody's looking for hard assets as they were in the last decade, and or as they were looking in the 70s. And all of a sudden you have commodities become an investment class as they did and emerged in the last decade.
Okay, now what about the increases from Iran and Iraq? How is that going to impact the markets if the United States is able to ramp up its production again?
Well, I mean, you got to remember when we talked about depletion, okay, we're talking about three countries that have the capability of increasing production within OPEC. That's Saudi Arabia and mainly Iran and Iraq. You have other members that are squeaking and squawking and saying, hey, we got to do something. This is really hurting our economies. Production is down in Africa. It's down in Indonesia. It's declining in Latin America. I mean, look what's going on in Mexico after literally 4 or 5 decades. You know, Mexico is finally starting to auction off oil leases to Western oil companies. So that goes to show you, because they've seen sharp declines in their major oil field, which is Canarel, which was the second largest producing oil field in the world. That oil field has gone into decline. So the Mexican government is also suffering too. So, you know, there are a number of countries that have gone into steep decline around the globe. And it's amazing that, you know, the United States, which had its production peak in 1971, would come back to a level that we haven't seen for almost 3 or 4 decades with the discovery of fracking, horizontal drilling, and shale oil.
Okay, so you believe then that we're close to a bottom. Now, the real question is, what happens from here? I mean, a big spike up, some kind of a shock, or is it just going to be a gradual increase, maybe a ramping up with spiked bumps along the way?
You know, I would expect a gradual increase by the time we get to the second half of the year. By then, U.S. oil production should be down close to 500,000 or 600,000 barrels. We'll be in the summer driving season. And also, as CapEx cuts and U.S. production cuts along with depletion begin to draw down inventories. I mean, we're starting to see things now, John, that we saw probably at the bottom of the real estate market. I'm thinking back to 2009. Some very smart money is starting to come into the oil markets. We're seeing a new IPO that's coming to the market, which is basically a blank check fund. It's raising money with the intent of buying distressed properties. There also, we're seeing hedge funds coming in, raising money for the same purpose. Very similar to what we saw happen in the real estate markets here in California, Vegas, Florida, Arizona in 2009 and 2010. You saw big hedge funds coming in, just buying large swaths of housing developments here in California, Vegas, and Florida, where we had this real estate glut, and they renovated them. And John, those people made a lot of money. There's a gentleman gentleman out there by the name of Mark Papa. Now, he might not sound familiar unless you're in the oil business. He was the gentleman that spun off from Enron, a company that was called EOG. And he ran that company until about 2013 when he decided to sort of go into retire. And EOG has been a pioneer in drilling techniques. They're a very large player in shale. And basically, when he saw what happened, he came out of retirement. He pushed his retirement back and he said, this is too good to be true. This is too good of an opportunity to pass up. So he is coming to market with an IPO. They're going to raise about $400 million right now. Private equity is coming into the field. Almost $100 billion has been raised to invest in oil and gas. And a lot of that money is sitting on the sidelines right now, waiting for the right opportunities. Because remember, a lot of these smaller companies that have debt that can't meet their debt payments, there's been, like as Gary Dorsch and I talked about in the first hour, we've seen anywhere from 40 to 50 companies file for bankruptcy. Well, what happens when they file for bankruptcy? The banks that made the loan, they're saying, hey, we don't know anything about the oil business. We don't want to manage it. So they're going to start liquidating those properties. And that's why private equity is waiting there. They're putting together the teams to take that oil into production and to buy it at incredible discounted prices from these banks. I mean, this week alone, J.P. Morgan announced that they're increasing their loan loss reserves by almost $600 million to account for these energy losses. And what's going to happen is you're going to see more of that take place this year. A lot of that credit is not going to be extended. A lot of these companies are going to go belly up. That means the banks are going to be sitting on all these oil properties. They don't want to sit and manage it. And that's why a lot of these hedge funds are now in private equity are coming in as the next big opportunity. It's kind of like what happened in the S&L crisis, where a lot of people became billionaires, including the Bass brothers, Kyle Bass, the Bass brothers, and I'm trying to think of Richard Rainwater, who recently passed away, just built fortunes in buying these distressed mortgages in the 90s. A lot of people made fortunes in real estate, buying distressed real estate after the financial crisis. Well, there's a sense right now in the private equity market and hedge fund market, this is the next opportunity.
Okay, speaking of opportunity, from an investment standpoint, where do we go?
You know, it's probably, if I was to get in this market, you know, I'd play it conservative at this point, because you never know if you've really hit a bottom. So, you know, I'd be looking at the large cap oil companies, the companies that have strong balance sheets, have the ability to maintain that dividend through the cut of CapEx. So, you know, I'm not going to recommend, but you know the companies I'm talking about. In the growth area, there are some really great, great companies. These are companies that are big shale players. They're big on technology. They're big on increasing production. And John, in a slow growth world, one of the key things that you want in the future over the next decade is finding a company that makes a product or does something that can increase and grow in a slow growth world. And there are many fine shale plays that are high quality companies that you might want to take a look at right now. It's probably a little bit too early on the oil service sector, but that's one area that we're looking at. You would really need a ramp up in CapEx spending, and I don't see that coming until probably the latter part of the year. Maybe that's a 2H story rather than a 1H story. But, you know, if you want to play it safe, look at high dividend paying blue chip. The big companies would probably be the safest way to play.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
You know, Financial Sense News Hour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense News Hour, featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
Joining us on the show today is Evelyn James Garris of the Browning World Climate Bulletin. And the Browning World Climate Bulletin is a key source of information describing the relationship between macro weather-related trends and their potential impact on energy, commodities, and the wider global economy. When we spoke to both of you last time, we had discussed El Nino and the impacts that it was having, particularly the chance of it weakening into a La Nina and some of the effects that this might have. in terms of drought and some drier conditions. And I'm looking at your most recent bulletin that you sent out for this month, and you also discuss in depth the Paris Agreement and what that means for the energy industry, the implications that it has for investors in terms of some potential opportunities, given a lot of the goals that were set forth. So I want to discuss that as well, because you have some really good insights there. But first, let's address El Nino and talk about what you guys see going forward. You did note that it is now peaking, and so we are seeing that fade. But give us an idea of what we should expect weather-wise going forward.
What we are seeing at this point is that while a lot of the east overall is drier in the northeast, you get these tremendous storms. And I would say that that's going to be what people notice the most as El Nino continues to weaken. What we are seeing is warmer weather along the Canadian-U.S. border, cooler weather in the U.S., and these extreme storms that in many cases are breaking records. So we have these record-breaking storms. But then when you look at the overall average, surprisingly, the overall average is not that extreme. When you look at the amount of water that we are getting, it is good along the south. But, for example, we aren't getting enough water to break the California drought. Most of the flooding that we have been seeing is because what snow is coming is being then hit by extreme warmth and melts quickly. So we are seeing a normal, strong El Nino pattern. And part of that includes extreme damaging weather. As the El Nino declines and becomes moderate, then for California, it means there's a good chance of a marvelous March or amazing April. Another good shot of water. Again, not enough to break the drought, but at least to give the state some relief. And potential dry planting conditions for the Corn Belt. And that's not good news. Then summer should be normal. Normal is a good thing. At that point, the El Nino is expected by most experts to be neutral. But they've just yesterday published an announcement that they see a 50% chance that a La Nina, and a La Nina is cold and dry, they see a 50% chance of a La Nina by autumn. And when I talk to them informally, I'm hearing closer to 70%. Now, if that happens, then it brings drier weather throughout the Great Plains and the Midwest towards the end of summer. And what will be key for the U.S. crop is, when does that dry weather hit? If it hits in July, then that's when corn silks. That's when the ears are set. And that can affect corn productivity. If it hits in August, that's a key month for soybeans. That's when the soybean pods are filling. If it hits in September, especially since we're seeing signs of a warm spring and a lot of insurers are sort of hinting to their clients, you might want to plant early. That would give us a dry harvest, which would be wonderful news for the farmer. Imagine having a dry, easy harvest season. If La Nina develops, then from the commodities point of view, prices of foods go up. If La Nina develops, the other thing is La Nina historically correlates with a dry winter for California because you have Mediterranean climate, and Mediterranean climate, you get most of your moisture in winter. So if they're right, again, it's a big if, they're positive enough, they're saying 50% and 70% informally, then that means that this respite that California has been getting, not enough to break the drought, but enough to give some relief, is going to be followed by another year of renewed drought and dry conditions for California. Also, during the La Nina, you get dry weather in southern Texas, Florida, California. In other words, all of our winter fruit and vegetable areas.
And welcome back to The Big Picture, part of the Financial Sense News Hour. In this part of the show, it is time to do an examination of the leading economic indicators, otherwise known as the LEIs. We know that economic growth dropped. Well, if we look at fourth quarter here, the fourth quarter GDP second pass slowed to a 1% growth rate, which is not really too great. And that, of course, raises the question of, I know the Fed may be trying to buy itself some wiggle room in there, but with growth almost stopped, you wonder why the Fed is doing what it's doing. But in the midst of all of this, Jim, what are the leading economic indicators actually telling you?
Well, you know, it was amazing because we were talking about, and especially when we were talking about whether the Fed was going to raise interest rates or not in the fourth quarter last year, which they finally did in December. John, the LEIs were slowing down, telling us that Q4 was going to be slow. The retail sales numbers were weakening. So the LEIs were telling us a slowdown was coming. And you saw that reflected in most of the major LEIs that we follow in the month of December. I would say, John, most of them, there was only like three that were positive. Most of them were either flat or negative. However, beginning in the month of January, we started seeing some small improvements in the LEIs, and we've seen that so far in the month of February. For example, the Empire Index, which is an LEI, major LEI, in December, it was a negative 6.2. And in January, it was negative 19.4. Once again, that slowdown. But in February, it was a negative 16.6. Same thing with the Philly Fed survey. It was negative in December, 10.2%. In January, it was negative by 3.5%. And in February, it was negative by 2.8%. Now, a lot of people would say, well, gosh, you know, it's still negative, which means that this isn't going to be a great booming economy for Q1. But we follow about 19 major indicators that we like to follow. And the one that people are really keeping a close look on, one was the ISM Manufacturing Index, which is a negative territory or contraction territory at 48. Anything below 50 means the economy is contracting. And that's certainly taken place in manufacturing. But what was alarming to see is what happened to the service sector LEIs, and especially the ISM non-manufacturing index. I mean, it was as high as 58 in October. It dropped to 56 in November. It dropped to 55 in December. In January, it dropped to 53. So remember, 70% of the U.S. economy is a service sector economy. So there's been a trend since summer that the LEIs, or at least the service sector, has been slowing down. You take a look at things like factory orders, a big, big drop. We haven't got the numbers yet for January. There's a little bit of a lag period behind that, but we saw a big drop off in November and December. You take a look at, once again, I mentioned the manufacturing index. It was hard to believe that it was positive in the summer at 53, although it had been trending down. And a lot of that reflects what is happening in the export sector, and the rise in the dollar was impacting U.S. manufacturing. It is now, all right, take it for what it is. It went from 48 in December to 48.2. Now, you might say, well, okay, a tick of 0.2. Well, you know, this is a nuanced market, and what they're looking at, it's not so much the degree, it's more of what's trending. Where is this trend going? Is it continuing on a downward trend, or have things started to change? And what we're starting to do, and this should be a familiar pattern to many of our listeners, where you'll see a weak spot in the fourth quarter, in the first quarter, and then things start to pick up in the second and third quarter. And that's what we're starting to see, John. Just, you know, it may be insignificant, but we're starting to see a slight uptick in some of these LEIs. I mean, you take a look at the New York survey, that is trending down. And that's what overall, if we were to take all these 19 indicators that we follow, the overall trend right now, it's kind of a mixed picture. And I guess what everybody's looking for is those little nuances. It's what is happening? What is the trend? And had it everything been trending down, then that would have been alarming. But the uptick is not as strong. But once again, it's very nuanced. It's very slight, but they're starting to tick up. The New York manufacturing sector has been ticking down. I mentioned the ISM service sector. We're going to get one of those reports here shortly. New orders for manufactured goods, that has been trending down for the last couple months. If we take a look at the ECRI Economic Leading Indicator Index, that has trended down just slightly, but it's been, once again, these little nuanced changes. It's gone from 130.6, and recently it's down to roughly 129.6. If you want to take a look at the Empire State Manufacturing Index, that has ticked up. It's negative. Once again, these are these kind of sort of little nuanced things. Instead of down 19.4%, it's down 16.6%, so still contracting. You take a look at other type of surveys, the NAHB Housing Market Index. That's one everybody's been watching, and especially auto sales, because the two strong sectors in the U.S. economy last year that were holding the economy up, it was service, it was housing, it was automobiles, almost record automobile sales last year. So that's why when the housing market starts to slow down, people start to wonder, you know, is there a change? Now, on the other hand, if you look at industrial production, that has been ticking up. So that would sort of line up with what we just saw, a slight improvement in the ISM Manufacturing Index. And I want to mention, too, in the budget deal that was passed by Congress in November, they busted the spending caps, and the budget deficit this year is going to increase by almost $200 billion. We're going from $400 billion to $600 billion because, let's face it, folks, Republicans and Democrats, both parties want to get reelected, and they show statistically in a political election, it's what is happening in the economy the first 6 months of the year in an election year is the key. So we've got a slight uptick. The Chicago National Activity Index is ticked up in the month of January. However, if you take a look at some of the regional Fed surveys from Richmond, that's ticking down.
Well, let me stop you there for a second, Jim. This pattern has been a recent development, let me put it that way, because we look like we're having the economy recover, lots of stimulus. But then as you get to the end of the year, there's a slowdown in the last quarter and also going into the first quarter of the new year.
You know, one of the things, John, there's a number of reasons. Some would cite weather because the weather has been unusual. So that has been a factor that's come into play. Another one, John, is rising healthcare costs, because a lot of the economists were puzzled. Like, according to AAA, the average American is saving probably about $1,000 a year on fuel costs. So, you know, $1,000, I mean, that's like a tax cut. And they were trying to figure out why this didn't translate into greater economic activity. But John, you know, healthcare premiums are sucking all that up. So rising healthcare costs has been one factor. Weather has been another factor. And then also the uncertainty of Fed actions. You know, were they or were they not? And then, of course, a lot of market turmoil that's coming from overseas. And, you know, when you have your manufacturing sector go into a recession, when you have a drop in your exports, even though exports only are 13% of U.S. GDP, nonetheless, you've got manufacturing slowing down. And then also take a look at what's going on in the energy sector. I mean, 300,000 jobs. And, John, these are high-paying jobs in all the associated industries that are involved with that. So I would say it's political uncertainty. It is financial uncertainty related to Fed policy. It's weather related. It's also rising healthcare costs, which are sucking up a lot of the savings that come from gasoline savings. So it's a combination of factors, and they seem to coalesce around the fourth and the first quarter of the year. But what we do know is we have almost $200 billion of government stimulus spending, and we could also see the Fed go on pause. But as Mark Chandler and I talked about in hour one, it's interesting with some of the improvement in some of these economic numbers, the futures market is pricing a higher probability of a hike come March. I just don't think there is enough evidence economically and certainly on the inflation front for the Fed to go, but they could always surprise people. But, you know, there are a lot of people outside the country that are talking to the Fed and say, what the hell are you doing? Because a Fed could create a crisis. A lot of people were saying that, well, they got to continue on with this talk because the Fed's credibility. But you noticed last time she was on Capitol Hill, the mention of negative interest rates came into play. And then also at the March meeting coming up shortly, that's the first revised forecast. The Fed gives a forecast in December in terms of what they think they're going to do with their rate hikes, what they think GDP growth is, unemployment rate, etc. The first revision to that forecast, and they revise it every year because the Fed has been overly optimistic. That first revised forecast is going to come in March. So that should tell us you know, whether they're going to go. I just don't think they're going to go in the first half of the year. I just don't. And if they do go, it would probably be September. I just don't see them raising in October right before a presidential election, especially with the Republicans wanting to audit the Fed. And quite honestly, that's not even going to make the Fed popular with its own party. Remember those clips that we heard on Capitol Hill? What, well, just a couple of weeks ago, John, that just wasn't Republicans that were taking jabs at Mrs. Yellen. It was also Democrats as well.
Now, what you were mentioning, Jim, was that last year, the things that were actually supporting the economy were the service sector and then autos and also housing. But now if we look at the LEIs, those things are weakening. So what is this going to tell us?
Well, I mean, that's a major concern. And that's why they're hoping that, you know, maybe the dollar has peaked, but I just don't think it has, given the negative interest rates we're seeing in Europe and in Japan, and then the slowdown in emerging markets. So there's still further room for the dollar to peak. So, you know, right now, John, we're paying very close attention to the service sector. We're watching housing. Housing tends to be a little bit erratic around this time of the year. You know, time will really tell in March to May, which are really prime buying season for housing. We'll see what happens there. I don't put too much credence on a downturn in the month of January and February. A lot of that is weather related. We had, I don't know what it was like for you, but we've gone from global cooling, one of the coldest winters that we've had, or coldest Januarys on record here in California, to the warmest February. I mean, it's like everybody around here is saying, what happened to winter? So I don't put too much credence in those kind of numbers. It's really not until we get to spring and early summer that we pay closer attention to the housing numbers. Of course, we're going to be watching automobile sales, but more importantly, we're watching that slowdown in ISM non-manufacturing, because that's 70% of the economy. And those three sectors, housing, auto, and the service sector, was what held up the economy and why the U.S. economy looks so much better than other economies around the world. The other thing that we're following is the uptick in global PMIs, which could be a positive here in the sense that a growing economy overseas would take some of the pressure off the dollar here, which also would be a stimulus. So right now, John, very nuanced improvement in some of these indicators, at least the early ones that are coming out in February. They began to increase slightly in January. We're seeing slight increases in the month of February, still negative and a very mixed picture. So let's put it this way, you know, first quarter, Q1, it's not going to be a barn burner, or it's going to be very weak. The question is, will things start to turn up in the second quarter? And watch for calls by the president and the Democrats for stimulus spending if this continues to weaken going into the second quarter, because past presidential elections, if the economy's weak in the first half of the year, that usually dooms the party in office heading into the fall elections. So this is something right now, still a mixed picture. It still tells us a very weak economy for Q1.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
You know, Financial Sense News Hour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense News Hour, featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
Will Donald Trump win the 2016 Republican presidential nomination? Will China's official annual growth rate for 2016 fall under 6.5% during this year? Or will any central bank of a sovereign state announce the use of Bitcoin or any cryptocurrency as a reserve asset by the end of 2017? These are some of the questions and events that people are forecasting on a new crowd-based platform or prediction market called Almanis. And the executive chairman of Almanis, it's actually Slow Voice, is the parent company which have created Almanis. Mike Halsall joins us today to tell us about the story, the science, and the technology behind crowd-based platforms, prediction markets, how they came to be, how they're evolving, and how they're leveraging today's technology to create Almanis. Mike, thank you for joining us on the show today.
Good to be speaking to you over here in the UK at the moment.
So, Mike, I just listed off a few of the questions that you have listed on Almanis that people are providing predictions on. The prospects for Donald Trump winning the 2016 Republican presidential election do not look good at 37%, I see, according to your crowd of forecasters. Before we go into some of the details of Almanis and how it differs from some of the other forecasting platforms out there, would you mind telling us a little bit about some of the background behind this idea of wisdom of crowds, where it started and how this is being used today?
Yes, certainly. I would say that the wisdom of crowds is a sort of a subset within a broader sphere of collective intelligence. And the success of prediction markets comes from really three things. The first is the purpose of them. They have to do something that is interesting and useful. The second thing is that those who engage and participate have to have some sort of incentive, which can in some cases be monetary or it can be some reputational advantage. And then the third piece, which is really, really important, is that you have to have an active and very diverse crowd or diverse sort of members within the crowd. And that then makes sure that you avoid all of the pitfalls of sort of groupthink and the mob effect that people sometimes refer to. So the important thing to remember about this sort of technology, which we've enhanced very significantly, is that it has very significant scientific background and evidence as to its success in making very, very good, accurate forecasts.
I always like to look at future trends, and that's what we're going to do here on this part of the program. We have decided to label this Things You're Going to Lose in the Not Too Distant Future. Now, it can't be my mind. I lost that a long time ago.
Yeah, I can attest to that.
I made a profit out of it. I went into radio after I lost my mind, and it seemed to have worked. So anyway, we've got 10 things that we're going to lose here. You want me to rattle them off first, then we'll take them, or what?
This was something my wife sent me an email, and we got this from a listener to the show. I'm not sure who the listener was, but it was called Things You Will Lose in the Not Too Distant Future. And I thought this was rather interesting because we've done a number of shows on megatrends. And the first one, this should come as no surprise to anybody if you live here in the United States or elsewhere. Number one, the post office. Now get ready to imagine a world without the post office. They are so deeply in financial trouble that there's probably no way to sustain it long term. I mean, think about it. Email, FedEx, and UPS have just about wiped out the minimum revenue needed to keep the post office alive. I mean, I don't know about you, John. What do you get in the mail? And the only thing I get is bills and junk mail.
Occasionally, there's important stuff, but you're right. It's largely bills and junk mail, and that's pretty much it. A lot more of the bills are coming over the internet, but what I object to right now is they don't just email me the bills. They make me go to the website and log in, and I calculated I could be spending several hours a month just doing that. So they're going to have to get around that.
Yeah, but sooner or later, and this may be something in a budget that, you know, the government starts to look at, because it's very hard to unwind a government agency, but, you know, it's bleeding right now, and about the only reason, and especially with everything going to the cloud, and as you just mentioned, some of the people that, you know, you have to pay your bills, they require you to go online and pay them. Number two, the personal check. Britain is already laying the groundwork to do away with financial checks by 2018. It costs the financial system literally billions of dollars a year to process checks. Plastic cards, online transactions will lead to eventual demise of the check. I mean, think about what Apple did with Apple Pay. This plays right into the death of the post office. If you never paid your bills by mail and never received them by mail, the post office would absolutely go out of business. So if we start getting rid of the check, this is one more nail in the coffin on the post office. This one, the newspaper. Let's face it, the younger generation simply doesn't read the newspaper. They certainly don't subscribe to a daily delivered print edition. That may go the way of the milkman and the laundryman. Do you remember that, John? You and I are both old enough to remember the milkman that used to deliver milk.
Well, I remember that back in 1910. Yes, I remember that.
For new listeners, John's a centenarian. So, you know, I don't know about you. I used to get the Wall Street Journal and the Financial Times delivered. Now, John, I just, you know, log on in the morning onto my computer. And if there's an article there, I just simply print it.
You know what I do for all my down dumps? I call them down dumps during the week for the news program. I just dump them, everything off the websites into a text file, and it comes up on my Kindle. And then when I'm done with it, I erase it. I do use some hard copy, but that's the way you get through a lot of amount of stuff. I found I had so many newspapers between the Wall Street Journal and the local papers. I had piles of newspapers, I kid you not, that I had to get rid of.
Yeah, we used to get the daily, and the only reason I kept it for a while was to find out what movies were coming out on the weekend. But now, you know, you can get that online. So, gosh, I think 2005 was the last time we got a newspaper. So let's face it, the rise in mobile internet devices, e-readers, as you just talked about, has caused all the newspaper and magazine publishers to form an alliance. They have met up with companies like Apple, Amazon, and the major cell phone companies to develop a model. They're working on a new model for paid subscription, folks. The days of free news service are going to go by the wayside because the paper business is going out. Here's one that kind of saddens me, and this is called the fourth thing that we're going to be doing without, is the book. You say you'll never give up the physical book that you hold in your hand and turn the literal pages. Well, you know, I said the same thing about downloading music from iTunes. I wanted my hard copy CD, but I quickly changed my mind when I discovered that I could get albums for half the price or just a couple songs without ever leaving home to get the latest music. They're saying the same thing is going to happen with books. You know, I certainly hope not. But I mean, you know, one of my routines, because I'm a prolific reader, is I used to spend Saturday mornings, you know, it used to be B. Dalton in the 90s, then it became Barnes & Noble or Borders, and especially with the coffee shop there, I'd go down there, I'd take a look at new magazines coming out, taking a look at the new books. That was part of my Saturday routine. John, I quit that probably about 2 or 3 years ago, because now I just go on Amazon, just take a look at new books. And if it's a new book, I just press a button and boom, it's shipped to my house. Or if it's somebody that I book that I don't want to wait, I just, you know, fire up my Kindle, press a button and boom, I've got the book in my Kindle in 2 minutes. So you think about not only the price savings, but also think of the convenience. So once you start flicking your fingers on the screen, instead of a book, you find yourself lost in the story. And already, John, they're already doing this in schools where they're using iPads in the schoolroom. So if we take a look at the first four, the post office, the checker related, the newspaper, the book, and, you know, I hope not the bookstore. This one should be obvious to all of us, the landline telephone. Unless you have a large family and make a lot of local calls and you don't need it anymore, most people keep it simple because they've always had it. But you are paying double charges for the extra service. All the cell phone companies will let you call customers using the same cell provider for no charge against your minutes. By the way, the phone book is also on the list for extinction too. So number five, the landline. Now, I'm trying to comprehend this one. Six is music. This is probably one of the saddest parts of the change story. The music industry is dying a slow death, not just because of illegal downloading. It's the lack of innovative new music being given a chance to get to people who would like to hear it. Greed and corruption is the problem. The record labels and the radio conglomerates are simply self-destructing. Over 40% of the music purchased today is catalog items, meaning traditional music that the public is familiar with. Older established artists, This is also true on live concert circuit. To explore this fascinating and disturbing topic further, there's a new book out called Appetite for Self-Destruction by Steve Knopper. It's K-N-O-P-P-E-R. And the video documentary Before the Music Dies. Number seven, this is interesting, especially with looking at Warren Buffett's career. He made a lot of money in television with owning ABC or Capital Cities. Network watching is down dramatically, not just because of the economy. People are watching TV and movies streamed from their computers. And they're playing games and doing lots of other things that take up the time that used to be spent watching TV. Primetime shows have degenerated down to lower than the lowest common denominator. Cable rates are skyrocketing and commercials run about 4 minutes and 30 seconds. I know when I was doing talk radio, I had an hour show, and of that hour between news and commercials, it was one third of the hour, over 20 minutes. What was it like when you were doing daily talk?
It depended. Let's see. We started at 4 after, and I think we hit our first break at 10 for 2. Am I right? And then maybe another one at 20 for 2. So that's 2, 4, 4, 4, 8. By the time we got to a half hour, and probably another 2 at the bottom 10. So 10 minutes out of 30 each half hour was devoted to something else. That did include news and some adjacencies in there.
Yeah, so just like me, 20 minutes, if you take 10 minutes out of the hour, one third of your listening time was commercials. So you think of all the commercials, that's one of the reasons Netflix and Hulu and many of these programs. I know for me, like if I want to watch a season, I don't watch it on television. I don't like the interruptions. I just wait till it comes out on Netflix or DVD, and I just get the whole series, and I don't have to put up with the commercials. And that's why the popularity of Netflix, which was one of the hot stocks last year. Number 8, the things that you own. Many of the very possessions that we used to own are still in our lives, but we may not actually own them in the future. Think of software for one. They may simply reside in the cloud. Today, your computer has a hard drive. You store your pictures, your music, your movies, your documents. Your software is on CD or DVD, and you can always reinstall it if need be. But all of that is changing. Both Apple, Microsoft, and Google are all finishing up their latest cloud services. That means that when you turn on a computer, the internet will be built into the operating system. So the Windows, Google, and Mac will be tied straight to the internet. If you click an icon, it will open something in the internet cloud. If you save something, it'll be saved in the cloud, and you're going to pay a monthly subscription fee, ongoing revenues. Now, that's good news, but you know, some of the stuff, I always wondered about this, and I'm a little bit concerned about this. John, what happens if we have a EMP attack or something like that? You remember, what was it in the last decade? I think it was GTE before they bought out. One of their satellites went kablink, and all of a sudden, anybody that had GTE cell service didn't have use of a cell phone.
It wasn't just that. If you remember, National Public Radio was on that satellite. It lost Earthlock is what it did, so it couldn't reorient toward the Earth. And NPR distributed on that satellite to all of their affiliates, and they literally just instantly went dark and stayed dark. And the way they see now, Jim, I'm going to the way they fixed that was to use landline dial up. So the stations could dial up for their shows until they could find another satellite to which to locate. And that took a couple of days to get arranged. And see, I remember asking that question. I was doing a project for a major radio network in New York one time, and I was working closely with the chief engineer. Now, this was about 20 years ago, so this may not be the same. So anyway, I said, you know, his name was Bob. So I say, Bob, you know, you've always got this emergency broadcast stuff. I said, what are your broadcast emergency contingencies for getting your signal out of Manhattan by some other way than you're using the microwave system now? And he laughed and he said, what contingency? And I thought, oh, really? That's really what I wanted to hear. And, you know, when you talk about EMP, there are three forms of ways we may lose our power grid, say, for example. One is electromagnetic pulse. The second one is a coronal mass ejection from the sun. And the third one is a cyber attack on power stations or on parts of the networks or other things like that. And instantly you're back in the dark ages again. People don't understand. The transformers, these are huge things at the major interchange stations, are made to order as they are needed. And they're made in two places, South Korea and Germany. They have to be loaded on a ship. They're big and very heavy, and then transported with great difficulty. Now, you're assuming, how long will it take to do that if we blow out X number of them? And there are ways now. They've already invented a device to take any kind of a long EMP spike and short it to ground for an entire station. It's a big little thing. They can make them. We can do it. But right now, the power companies are balking at it, and the government hasn't been stringent about it. But that's going to be on a high, I think, the number of people, even James Woolsey, former director of the CIA, did an interview on it. He says, this is something we must do. I don't care what the cost is. We must do it.
Living here in San Diego, we had a power station that was knocked out on the Arizona border in literally the city of San Diego went dark for almost 6 to 8 hours. It's one of the reasons we're installing solar and we're going to be using Tesla house batteries, which basically takes us off the grid, because in my business, I have to have a backup system. And so that's happened a number of times here.
I don't know if you have seen the German commercial where the husband is using his iPad and his wife's always printing out hard copy. And the whole commercial goes from start to finish. You know, she's sitting next to him and she's reading a book and he's reading it on his iPad. And he goes, Emma, you know, and then the next one, she's printing out hard copy and he's showing her how she could read it on the iPad. And he goes, Emma, and it goes through the whole thing. And finally, the last scene of the commercial is he's sitting on the John. And he turns to grab the toilet paper and there isn't any. And he yells, Emma! And she shoves the iPad under the door and it's got a picture of a roll of toilet paper. And that was the message of the commercial, that you're not totally done with paper yet. You know, great German commercial.
Well, speaking of getting rid of paper, number 9, joined handwriting or cursive writing, already gone in some schools who no longer teach joined handwriting because nearly everyone is done now on computers or keyboards of some type. So that. Number 10, privacy. I was in Arizona last weekend, and it's amazing because I grew up there. I moved to San Diego in 82, and John, on every single stoplight, there were cameras, not only trying to get you for speeding on every single corner, but cameras on above that were recording you. And if there's one thing that we're losing, it's privacy. If there ever was a concept that we can look back on nostalgically, it would be privacy. That's gone. It's been gone for a long time now. There are cameras on the street and most of the buildings and even built into your computer and cell phone. But you can be sure that 24/7, they know who you are and where you are, right down to the GPS coordinates and the Google Street View. If you buy something, your habit is put into zillion profiles and your ads will change to reflect your buying habits. They will try to get you to buy something else again and again. And most people don't realize when you walk in department stores, you're on camera. They're looking at what kiosk or what display you go to. They're in the malls. And remember, John, with the Boston bomber in the marathon run, they picked up the suspect on camera because the streets are all watched. So smile, you're on candid camera. But I thought it was interesting. 10 things that, you know, we're going to do without. And when you think about some of these, were pretty obvious when you think about at the beginning. The post office, the check, the newspaper, the book, the landline, music, television revenues, things that you used to own like CDs and software and music, and then handwriting and privacy. But anyway, we just thought we'd kind of share this with you. It really struck me about how much our life has changed as a result of technology, but also because of intrusion as never before. We're going to pick up on this megatrends theme. We're going to update that in an upcoming show.
I will say this much. I have invented cursive computing. Did you know that?
Cursive computing. Explain that one.
You should see me. Okay, I'm sitting here typing, right? Oh, son of a gun! Doggone it! Why isn't it doing it? See, that's cursive computing. I can't get the computer to do what I want.
Oh, okay.
And then you start cursing, you know? So.
Oh, okay.
And by the way, you know, if you lose privacy, are we losing privacy as well? Do you suppose they're both going?
I think both.
Both of them. Oh, doggone. I thought we were going to keep one up and the other going. All right. So that's so much for that. Look forward to covering these mega trends in the future. Speaking of covering things in the futuro and el futuro, what are we doing looking for this coming week and in the months to come?
Well, I would say probably the economic numbers. We're going to have an unemployment report coming up for the month of February. The amount of jobs creating have been slowing down, along with the slowdown that we saw in fourth quarter GDP. We'll see if that trend is continuing. I think, John, everything is going to be focusing on what's happening in the economy. This is an election year. And if the economy is really starting to slow down, the Fed has really got to be thinking, what the heck are we doing raising rates when things are moving south? As we mentioned, as we talked about the LAIs, we've seen a slight nuanced uptick, but nothing great right now. But LEIs right now is what we're going to be looking at in the month of March. And then, of course, towards the end of March, we should start hearing some rumblings on corporate earnings. But I would say the economic numbers and the Fed is in the month of March. LEIs are picking up overseas. We'll see if that translates into further strengthening of economic growth. That could take some of the pressure off on the dollar. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, well, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.